Natural Living with Gary Nall, Mondays and Tuesdays at 3 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. This is the Empowerment Hour. I can assure you, you're going to learn some things that will help allow you to make better choices in your life. Today, our guest in the second part of our program will be Dr. Ronald Riker. Dr. Riker is a psychiatrist, board-certified, specializing in depression, anxiety, ADHD, and psychopharmacology. And he is trained in treating emotionally and behaviorally and educationally disturbed children and adolescents. Our theme, the drugging of our children, and the new Diagnostic and Statistical Manual number 4. That's the Bible Psychiatry. I will be challenging him to give me any proof that he has that any psychiatric condition can be proven by any blood chemistry or brain chemistry test. I do not believe any such evidence exists, and yet watch every single ad on television. If you are suffering from these symptoms, you probably have a brain chemical imbalance. Take this drug. It's a massive fraud, and it'll be an interesting discussion. Before we get there, however, on our environmental level, I'm going to talk about 5 mining projects the average American has no knowledge of. Even environmentalists don't know about this. And I'll be sharing some insights from Subhankar Banerjee from Climate Storytellers, my own research when I'm doing my film, The 12 Tipping Points. Water or cola? Which is better for you? Well, more people drink cola than water with an active interest in having hydration. And then I'm going to ask you to do a little test using water or cola. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. As you know, I'm a big believer in antioxidants because antioxidants are the one nutrient group that we know for sure, there's no controversy about this, will trap free radicals and neutralize them. We also know that free radicals are the primary reason that all diseases occur and that we prematurely age and ultimately develop the diseases that kill us. Heart disease, cancer, diabetes, arthritis, these are all due to free radicals, and the free radicals and inflammatory agents are caused by what we eat, breathe, drink, what we use, computers, cell phones, microwaves, hair dryers, any television set if you sit within 3 feet of it. Now, the more antioxidants you take from a variety of sources, the more these free radicals you trap. When you trap a free radical, it's neutralized and therefore it does no harm. The more often that you take these antioxidants, the better it is for you. So another positive in the side of the column of those of you using antioxidants, this is in the peer-reviewed journal Diabetes, and here's what it says. Antioxidants have a protective effect in this particular experiment that was done, University of Pennsylvania and Tufts University, and what they found was that the antioxidants help decrease the adipose accumulation, in this case in the animals, but you can look at the number of women who are pregnant taking antioxidants and then realize that that is going to make a difference in their developing children, hence less adipose, hence less glucose intolerance, hence more normal blood sugar, and therefore it's entirely possible to help prevent obesity and diabetes at the very earliest stages of life. So, that's important. This morning I was at a school in New Jersey and for 9th and 10th graders and talking about health and nutrition and getting the whole school as a project for 3 months to go on a healthy protocol. And the school's going to provide fresh-made juices each morning. Grape juice, apple juice, orange juice, and a kind of a vegetable tomato type of VA juice. And then later in the day, they'll have a choice of healthy, organic, gourmet foods. And then every 2 weeks, a discussion about what all this means as far as lowering blood pressure, making them healthier. I'm donating my time and recipes and expertise because I see so many of these children have parents, even though the children are not overweight, but the parents are. And so it's one way to help the African-American and Latino community that has the highest incidence of heart disease per group in the United States, and they're dying at very rapid rates from stroke, heart attack, and diabetes. And it's 100% Latino and African-American. And there are two separate schools that are participating in this, one in Newark and one in Fairfield, or Plainview. In any case, when I mention tomatoes, someone says, well, what exactly do tomatoes do? Well, according to a study I just read early this morning from the peer-reviewed journal Osteoporosis International, research done at the University of Toronto, as little as 30 milligrams of lycopene found in tomatoes, that's equivalent to just, oh, 2 glasses of tomato juice, that's enough to help prevent osteoporosis, or the brittling of the bones. And that's good, because it's easy to have, and that's a small glass of tomato juice. If you had a normal 16-ounce size of tomato juice, and you threw some garlic in there, and some onion, some cayenne, it's delicious tasting. You really want to ratchet up the taste. Put in a little bit of ginger and horseradish. Now you've got a all-around juice tempered off with a little bit of honey. It will kill strep. It will kill staph. It will kill bad bacteria. It is an enormously important juice to help prevent colds and flu. And it also, according to this study, will help prevent osteoporosis. And a lot of people have thinning of the bones. Over 75 million adults in the U.S., Europe, and Japan now have osteoporosis. There's no reason for this. This is completely preventable, but not based upon drinking colas. Remember, caffeine in coffee or colas act as a diuretic, and they also chelate out calcium. And so the more coffee and soft drinks you drink, the more likely you are to have a problem. Now, I'm going to raise a little question, and I'm going to take some answers for this before we go to our guest. Here's our thought of the day. This is Mike Adams. Pharmaceutical industries are rushing to create a drug that can erase your memories. You heard me right. Let me quote this. Quote, drug researchers are working on a mind-altering chemical that could erase your memories. It's all being pursued under the umbrella of mental health, which claims that this could help victims of emotional trauma. The idea can be to heal a patient by chemically lobotomizing them. That is, of course, entirely consistent with the core mythology of modern medicine. If something's wrong, you should poison it, burn it, irradiate it, or cut it out, and then pronounce the patient healed. In the case of memory-erasing drugs, scientists are reportedly working on a drug that would remove certain proteins from the brain's fear center. This is based upon the ludicrous idea, by the way, that memories are recorded only by physical proteins in the brain, an idea that has never been proven. And in fact, it's a very outmoded mechanistic model of the human mind and brain. Then again, modern medicine science seems to be hopelessly stuck in the dark ages, believing there must be a chemical cure for everything. Hence the ongoing waste of billions of dollars searching for a cancer cure as if it were some sort of infection. Quote, erasing a memory and then everything had bad built on that is an amazing idea, and I can see all sorts of potential. So said the National Institutes of Mental Health expert on this. Well, what are your thoughts? Would you want to see drugs that erase memories? How do you see that going down in a society of young people that are not prepared to deal with life's crisis and as we're unfolding these crises today? What would it mean? I'd like your opinion, your input. Give me a call, 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Now, there's a very good study on olive oil and seeing if olive oil could help people who have fatty liver. And we know that 1 in 3 adults have fatty liver, non-alcoholic fatty liver, and it will kill you. It's very bad. It's that silent epidemic out there because you can't feel it. This research was done at the Laboratory of Biochemistry, Human Nutrition Metabolic Disorder Center, and Tunisia, in the Department of Histology and Cytogenetic at the Faculty of Medicine there. Here's what they found. Olive oil's beneficial effects are not only related to its high content of oleic acid, but also its antioxidant potential and its polyphenols. In this study, they assessed that extra virgin olive oil and its fractions on 2,4-D-induced oxidative damage in the liver, quote, conclusions, and they showed that it had a protective effect against oxidative damage in the liver. That's good news. So for any of you who know anyone who has problems with their liver or has a fatty liver, then they should be taking 2 teaspoons a day of olive oil. And finally, rounding up the back end of our health and nutrition segment here, if you are diabetic, you definitely need antioxidants. A separate study published in Science Daily and the Endocrine Society's annual conference, this was presented, and it said the following, quote, a diet rich in natural antioxidants improves insulin sensitivity in insulin-resistant obese adults and enhances the effects of insulin-sensitizing drug metformin, and this was done in Italy. The beneficial effects of antioxidants are known, but we have revealed for the first time one of their biological bases of action, improving hormonal action in obese subjects with metabolic syndrome. This was done at Catholic University of the Sacred Heart in Rome. So once again, antioxidants, vitamin C, vitamin E, tocotrienols, lutein, lycopene, quercetin, resveratrol, these are what we should be consuming daily, and that can help us, if you're diabetic, have better insulin utilization, and that's important. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. We have a lot to talk about. Hopefully you'll call in and we'll see what you think about a new drug to erase memory. Well, my goodness. 888-874-4888. Earlier today on a different program, I spoke with a person about some incidents of 9/11. He was not able to be on today's show, so I'm going to do a full hour. And on this hour, we will be asking the following questions. Who had the means, the wherewithal, the technology, the money, the security clearances in order to set detonations in the three different buildings that many scientists now believe, based upon the thermitic materials discovered, could have brought down the buildings at 9/11. And he will be laying out his research in detail at that time. But he won't be on today. He was supposed to be, but he won't. And if we're looking for some calls, I want to hear your thoughts. In the interim, here are some things we should be aware about on the environment. First, I'm very concerned that when the Gulf oil crisis was going on, we weren't told about the other places that had problems. We know now that Shell Oil has really put its efforts behind an enormous advertisement campaign with lots of lobbyists heading on the Obama administration to get permission for them to drill in the Beaufort Sea of Arctic Alaska. That's a reality. They want to start this drilling within the next few months. Now then, the first question is, how much oil is up there, the fossil fuel that they could take out of the ground and then process? Well, they estimate that there's about 30 billion barrels of oil in the Beaufort and the Chukchi Seas of Arctic Alaska. Okay. Well, that sounds like a lot, 30 billion barrels. Whoa. Until you realize that the United States uses 7.5 billion barrels of oil a year. So divide 7 into 30, 7.5, and you end up with 4 years with oil. So what could possibly go wrong? Well, how about creating dead zones? And when you create a dead zone that they've already created in the Gulf of Mexico, where nothing can live, no aquatic life, creating a dead zone in cold water is worse because you have a very slow-growing habitat that will take hundreds of years to heal, unlike the warm Gulf water, where things grow much, much more quickly. So I would say stop Shell from drilling in America's Arctic seas. And also the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge will be affected, and that's the most biologically diverse conservation area in the Arctic. And right there, they could end up causing oil spills as well. And so that's a no-brainer. Then we have the coal in the Yukatok River and upland in the Arctic Alaska. Now, we're talking about the northwest Arctic Alaska, and that's where they want to dig deep. Why do they want to dig up in Alaska for coal? Simple. They estimate that it has the largest single coal veins of bituminous coal in the world, 3.5 trillion tons of this coal. That would be over 10% of the world's known coal reserves. Now, how much do we consume in the United States each year? 1 billion tons. And they've got 3.5 trillion. That means that we could continue burning coal for 3,500 years in the United States. Of course, the reason why that we have global warming in no small measure is due to the coal we've burned in the last 200 years. And also you would affect the caribou herd. Now, why is that important? There's only about a little over 300,000 or 400,000 of these animals. Well, because 40 different indigenous communities from three tribes, including the Inuit and the Yupik and the Athabascan, rely upon this for food and clothing and spiritual ceremonies. And also that coal is on or near the surface of the land, meaning they're going to do mountaintop removal. So pristine Alaska would look like scarred and mangled West Virginia, where I came from. So I would say no to that. Then also, you have the tar sands and the shale oil in Alberta, Canada. But we have found it in the Rocky Mountains and the Great Plains. In a piece from the Yale Environment 360, I'll quote this, Keith Schneider points out some disturbing numbers. Quote, the tar sands region of northern Alberta, Canada, contains recoverable oil reserves, conservatively estimated 175 billion barrels, and with new technology could reach 400 billion barrels. And Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming hold oil shale reserves estimated to contain 1.2 trillion to 1.8 trillion barrels of oil. If current projections turn out to be accurate, there would be enough oil and gas to power the United States for another 100 years. Okay, one catch. Tar sands and shale oil are the dirtiest form of energy on the planet, and they're the most environmentally destructive in its recovery and production. They produce far more greenhouse gas than conventional oil and gas, meaning more accelerated climate change and requiring huge amounts of water for their production. It takes 6.5 gallons of water to produce 1 gallon of tar sand oil. Well, just figure it out. It's simple. You've heard me on this program talk about that there are 13 states in the United States that are running out of water. Their underground aquifers do not have enough reserve to support industry, agriculture, and consumer use. And so you can look at places in central and southern Texas, and also in Utah, Wyoming, Colorado, Nevada, New Mexico, and Oklahoma and California, they're running out in Arizona. They're running out of water. There's simply not going to be enough there. So now you want to take a place that's already in drought alert, that's already in water crisis, and take an enormous amount of what's left for producing this. It makes no sense. But again, when they're trying to say something, they never tell you the downside of that. And then we have to take a look, once again, take a look around at Appalachia. There's a very brave person in Washington, D.C. There are a lot of brave people out there. We got a lot of them in this audience, who scientists and people working in different agencies who know the truth and do what they can with it. But there's one that stands out. His name is Dr. James Hansen. Dr. Hansen is one of America's most esteemed climate scientists. He, along with 100 other activists from Appalachia Rising, were arrested in front of the White House in Washington, D.C. for protesting mountaintop removal and coal mining in Appalachia. And, quote, "Appalachian residents are calling the EPA to halt any new permit on the upcoming decision over the massive Spruce Mountain top removal mine." And by the way, the Spruce Mountain number one mine in Logan County, West Virginia, would be a gigantic mountaintop removal mine that would bring great devastation to the region, making it look like a moonscape. It would destroy thousands of acres of pristine forest. It would virtually bury 7 miles of streams, and it would simply end the way of life for Appalachian families. So how much coal is in Appalachia? The Energy Information Administration has estimated that there are 53 billion tons of coal reserves in the Appalachian Basin, and that means that they're going to be digging there for the next 100 years. Well, if you were President of the United States and you saw people protesting outside, first you'd want to know what they're protesting about. That's reasonable. And then if they're protesting to support and protect our environment, and some of America's leading environmentalists and climatologists are part of that, then you would assume that these are well-informed individuals who've taken their capacity as academicians and scholars to review the information. They're not going to put their reputation on the line and be arrested unless they really believe that what they're doing is right. So I would think that the President of the United States would have gone outside and said, hey, let's talk. You're here to protest this and you want to protect Appalachia? I do too. And I think the American public wants to protect it, especially when we take a look at all those places in Appalachia that used to be pristine and beautiful and what they look like today. So why don't we all just sit down here on the White House lawn? I'll bring out some lemonade and let's see what you have. And I'll bring in my, I'll call over the head of my EPA and call over all. No, this president, forget it. Go back to when this president was not the president, and you'll see that he was the one who was chosen as the front person to create the myth, the oxymoronic concept of clean coal. We forget that Barack Obama was a lawyer protecting the interests of the nuclear industry and the coal industry. So instead of protecting the rights of people to protest in a reasonable, nonviolent, and responsible way, they were arrested. And that's how it is today in America. I'm Gary Noll. This is the one place that will speak truth to power. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'm Gary Noll, my guest standing by, Dr. Ronald Riker. He is, as I mentioned, his background. He is a graduate of University of California, Berkeley, Tufts University School of Medicine, a researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health for the study of drug addiction, and he has been a contributing editor. Nice to have you with us, sir.
Nice to talk to you.
I want to begin by taking a look at the overdrugging of our children in the United States, and especially the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Psychiatry, the Bible of Psychiatry. And if you would, go into this and tell me from your research how much of this is authentic science that can be substantiated and how much of it is speculative guessing. And thirdly and lastly, why would they create diseases from such normal activity as speaking back to people? That is now a new defiance disorder. Or not choosing to speak up, that is a shyness disorder. Or not always feeling comfortable out in the public, a social anxiety disorder. To me, that seems like they're throwing such a broad net over the American public that they virtually pathologized everyone. Your thoughts, please.
Well, you know, you just asked a whole bunch of questions. I'm not too sure where to start. I think maybe start with the first questions you asked about in terms of drugs, how much science is behind these drugs like SSRIs. Those are antidepressant selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. The science is that for example supports using SSRIs, especially in children, is basically not there. Unfortunately, sometime around the 50s, 1950s, the world of psychiatry changed, and the hope that the psychiatrists had was that somehow they could fit more into the medical model of things. A human mind just does not fit that way. But that was the hope, that drugs could be found, such as an SSRI, that would cure depression. This is just an example. The theory was that what caused depression in both children and adults was low serotonin. The way the brain works is the brain has 1.5 trillion neurons. It's a huge amount of neurons that there's sending and receiving neurons. In between those two, there's what's called a cleft. And that would be, for example, where serotonin would reside. Serotonin is a neurotransmitter. So serotonin would be sent by the sending neuron, received by the receiving neuron. Sort of analogous to insulin and diabetes. In other words, if a person has diabetes, their pancreas doesn't work right, you give them insulin, and it's a big help. So the idea, someone came up with the idea that low serotonin equaled depression. So that's sort of where the SSRIs came in. They what they basically do is they block the reuptake of serotonin back into the sending neuron, keeping serotonin in this cleft longer than usual. That was supposed to be what would, because you had more serotonin there, that was supposed to be something that would then, therefore, decrease depression. Well, it doesn't. And as a matter of fact, conversely, it causes, especially in children, all kinds of problems in the brain. Brain doesn't like it when you, this is sort of a model of all these drugs, but the brain doesn't like it at all when its natural state is disturbed, or a word that really attracts me is perturbed, not just used initially by me, but in any event. So when you change something in the brain, such as this serotonin level, The brain does things to bring the brain, at least from the brain's point of view, back to what it calls normal. With serotonin, for example, what the brain does are two things. First of all, it decreases the production of serotonin, which, of course, is the exact opposite of what the supposedly beneficial effect would be. And the receptors on the receiving neurons, they die out. So that from the brain's point of view, things look more normal. Looks to the brain like there's less serotonin, the regular amount of serotonin, where what's actually happened is there's less serotonin. So these drugs have, rather than increase serotonin, they've managed to decrease it. That's that process where things seem to go backwards is true of both SSRIs, stimulant drugs, major tranquilizers, and so forth. So the actual science, there is science there. The science is wrong, but on the other hand, the alacrity with which that wrong science is found and the examples that are, the result from that of drugs are taken off the market. It just doesn't work that way. These drugs not only are still on the market, but the usage of them has increased tremendously and is increasing tremendously.
I appreciate that answer. Thank you. Are you at all affected emotionally by the idea that very powerful pharmaceuticals, especially those used in children, do not have to be effective or safe to be successfully marketed and kept out there for long periods of time, even after we have seen serious side effects?
You know, Gary, I'm sorry, there was a moment just before you finished what you were saying when my phone just dropped out, so I didn't hear the first part of it.
I said, how do you respond when you look at the science and realize that this generation of children are being medicated unlike any generation in history, and we're seeing the consequences in ways we've never seen before? When you and I were going to school, how many people committed suicide?
Well, I'll tell you, that's a very good question. How does one respond? Here we are in 2010, and we're most of my fellow physicians, psychiatrists in particular, we're still using these drugs that the science is lacking. The actual danger of them is pretty well obscured. I don't know any other way to put it than it's horrifying to me. And for whatever it's worth, right up until maybe the last year and a half, sad to say, I mean, I participated unwittingly in using drugs like, SSRIs plus the other ones we've spoken of. And unfortunately, I would be a couple of years ago a great model or example of many psychiatrists. The drug companies, that's a big part of this. The drug companies got heavily involved in making psychiatric drugs starting somewhere in the 70s, and it's just gone up and up and up. The level of corruption that exists between the drug companies, the doctors that support them, support the research, and unfortunately the FDA, there's just a real breakdown of clear-cut scientific thinking. A large part of the motive appears to be financial. A lot of that comes from drug companies, which I'm sure you're aware. I mean, they make huge amounts of money. In saying this, I know I could end up sounding really paranoid about this, but that's just the way it is.
So
So it's,
take us in. If that's the case, then take us to the Bible of psychiatry that allows for insurance companies to cover it. Mandates that various states, Medicare and Medicaid, also have a number system for it, and yet it's not being challenged. The diseases themselves are not being challenged as, well, like heart disease or cancer. Those are real diseases. You can find biological markers in the body. There are blood tests we can take. There are physical exams we can take. And yet the DMS-IV just continues to pump out more of these illnesses. And I challenge them. I say, show me the hard scientific gold standard proof that this is anything other than your own subjective opinion of what you think is not normal behavior. And then why is it that anger is not normal? Why is it that defiance is not normal? If we had the DMS-IV when I was growing up, and it was applied in the same broad strokes today, we would have had no sexual revolution, no feminist revolution, no civil rights revolution. We'd have had no social movements towards justice and equality at all. We would have sat back with the Vietnam War and said, well, if I protest, I'll be diagnosed as mentally ill and I can be drugged. If I, and look where we would have been, and we'd have had high suicide. Today, the number one cause of death in 10 to 14-year-old boys is suicide. I went to the largest high school in the state of West Virginia, Parkersburg High School. In my entire 3 years, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, there was not one single suicide in that high school with over 3,500 students. Today, oh yeah, you would have a lot of suicide or thoughts of suicide. One in five children today, between the ages of 8 and 12, and 1 in 6 children between the ages of 10 and 16 think of suicide, and a lot attempt suicide. So I'm connecting some of the dots here that I'm concerned that the psychiatric profession and the neurological profession and the media and the scientific community has failed or chosen not to examine. Your thoughts, please.
Well, what can one say? You're absolutely right. The DSM-IV, in fact, there's going to be a DSM-5 in, I think, in 4 or 5 years. The number of diseases that are quote-unquote diseases that DSM, in this case 4 still, lists has grown exponentially. The description of individual, so-called diseases has broadened. And then the use of drugs, that's what you just can't forget. And for example, when you're talking boys 10 to 14, I don't know the numbers. I would guess that a large number of the kids who have actually committed suicide, a large number of them probably were treated with SSRIs earlier, and that's what actually has led, I don't know what you want to call it, depression revolution, where, things are just out of balance and getting more and more so. The use of drugs on kids is, the age is getting lower and lower. I don't know. I feel it's sort of stupid. I mean, there's so many mistakes and wrong thinking in all of this that it's, I don't know. It sort of takes your breath away. I'll give you an example. In DSM-IV, I'm sure heard of attention deficit disorder or ADHD. That's the attention deficit disorder with hyperactivity. If you happen to have a copy of DSM-IV in front of you right now, they would give you criteria to identify a person as having, or a kid as having, ADHD. If you read over the criteria, and I don't happen to have it in front of me right now, there's a set of 10 questions. And if a person hits 6 of 10, then that means they have ADHD. The questions that are asked, that you have to answer, are such that if any of us read the questions and answered them, we would all determine that we had ADHD. I'll give you an example question. This happens to be number one. Do you ever lose your keys? Well, Everybody loses their keys.
Everyone.
Do you ever not listen when someone is speaking to you?
Everyone. Well,
everybody listens, has occasions, some more, some less, where not listening when someone is speaking to us. So the questions are that lead to the diagnosis. The questions are such that they're all inclusive, that everybody fits in. And that's true of many of the quote-unquote diagnoses that are in DSM-4. It's really awkward. So somebody says, I have ADHD and I took this test and therefore I need to get stimulant drugs because I got ADHD because I took this test. I mean, the whole thing is fallacious. And yet, you know, there you are. So you have your DSM-4. You have these descriptions. It's kind of fun to read. I mean, it's sad but fun. If you flip through the at least large parts of DSM-4 and read the criteria that go with any of these supposed disease states, you'll find you have every one of them according to DSM-4, which makes it basically useless. Also, you know, for whatever it's worth. In DSM-4, there's no number that says no diagnosis. So if you or I or any of us went to see a psychiatrist for whatever, let's say you're upset with your wife, you want some counseling, there's nothing wrong with you. You don't, you have no emotional or mental disease, you're upset. There's no place that where the physician or the psychiatrist can write down no diagnosis. And so in order to deal with an insurance company, they're going to have to put down a diagnosis. So no matter what, if you go to see a mental health professional who has to write something down to send to an insurance company, you just got a diagnosis, even though that may not be the case at all. But that's how DSM-4 works.
Okay. Final question. For those of us in this audience who are concerned about the overdrugging of our children, the overdiagnosing with dubious titles, what can we do now to put the brakes on this before the next diagnostic and statistical manual comes out and virtually all children and teens are susceptible? Right now, 30% of all college students every day are taking Adderall on a regular basis. And as you know, Adderall is it's 100% amphetamine. It's pure speed. And that really wrecks havoc with a person's brain. Yet it gives them that euphoria of speeding up and enhancement of their cognition. We're becoming addicted to these. What can we do?
Well, I'll tell you, Adderall happens to be one of my least favorite, drugs. I think your 30% figure is low. I think it's higher than that. I'm here in Los Angeles. I'm not too far from, and these are just typical schools. University of Southern California is nearby. UCLA isn't too far away. I think the number is closer to 50% than to 30, but I'm sort of a crusader. I end up seeing I'm a crusader. It's like I'm Don Quixote tilting at windmills. But nevertheless, the kids and young people, young adults that I see who do use Adderall, and as you say, it's speed, and lest we forget, speed kills. They take it. Apparently, I'm still trying to figure out what the benefit is. They're supposedly, you know, back when I was in college, we would take Dexys. That was Dexedrine, which is a form of amphetamine. During the week before finals, so you could stay up late and hopefully study better and and get a higher grade. Well, that's not the kind of use it's getting these days. It's used daily, varying amounts. What I find is that patients that I see who claim to have, it's funny, I should add parenthetically, they claim to have AD or ADHD. They don't even have a clue. Even if they use DSM-4, they don't know. So in any event, the list of possible side effects from amphetamine is really impressive. Those are things like sudden death, heart stoppage, high blood pressure. I mean, the list is really long. There's also in terms of emotional problems that can happen from it. Amphetamine does cause people to to be anxious, to feel high, and so on. Sometimes those very symptoms then lead on to another diagnosis, which is even worse, which is manic depressive disorder or bipolar disorder, which now those kids are going to, or those young people are going to get treated with a whole cocktail of drugs, every single one of which is really dangerous. I don't know. It's a really interesting problem. When people come to me to talk about getting Adderall, I mean, I'm sure when they leave, they probably wish they'd never talked to me. So I go over all this stuff with them and in some detail, including some very recent things. And it's really amazing the how unimpressed these young people are with all of these problems is startling. They just you can't talk them out of it.
Okay.
I don't know. We've had in the past, which was very unsuccessful, our war on drugs and so on. So I'm sort of falling into the educational approach to this, and what I find is that
Dr. Ronald Riker, we're out of time for this segment. Thank you very much for coming on and sharing your insights. Again,
how people can ignore the...
he is with was with the National Institutes of Mental Health and Tufts University School of Medicine. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment to talk about water versus cola. Round up our program today, a little discussion and an experiment. Water. Well, it's 75% of Americans are chronically dehydrated, and that's most of the people in the world. That means loss of energy and stamina, vitality. 37% of Americans, the thirst mechanism is so weak that they mistake the one mechanism for hunger. Even mild dehydration will slow down one's metabolism by 3%. One glass of water will shut down midnight hunger pangs for almost 100% of dieters studied in the University of Washington study. Lack of water, the number one trigger for daytime fatigue. Preliminary research indicates that 8 to 10 glasses of water a day could significantly ease back and joint pain for up to 80% of sufferers. A mere 2% drop in body water can trigger fuzzy short-term memory, trouble with basic math, and difficulty focusing on a computer screen or printed page. That's why we need to have our kids have water. Now, let's take a look at the other side of this. So I believe that we are severely dehydrated and we've got to get a handle on it. Now we look at cola. In many states, the Highway Patrol carries cola in the trunk to remove blood stains from the highway after a car accident. Try this. Try putting a T-bone steak in a bowl of cola and see if it's still there 2 days later. Try cleaning your toilet. Put a can of cola into the toilet bowl and let the cola sit there for 1 hour, then flush it. See if the citric acid in the cola removes stains as it's supposed to. To remove rust spots from chrome on a car's bumper, rub the bumper with a rumpled up piece of Reynolds wrap, aluminum foil dipped in cola. To clean corrosive material from car battery terminals, pour the cola, a can, over the terminals to bubble away the corrosion. To loosen rusty bolts, apply the cola to a cloth and then work on it for several moments, and it should relieve itself. And then also to make a moist, well, I won't even get into that. To remove grease from clothes, empty a can of cola into the load of greasy clothes and add detergent and run through a regular cycle. The cola will help loosen the grease stains and also clean road haze from your windshield. And also, the active ingredient in cola is phosphoric acid. It will dissolve a nail in about 4 days. Phosphoric acid also leaches calcium from your bones and is a major contributor to rising increase in osteoporosis. And it's also in the cola syrup. The commercial trucks must use a hazardous material place cards reserved for highly corrosive materials. And the distributors of cola have been using it in some cases to clean engines of the trucks for many years. So the question is, cola or water? And finally, something for those of you who are baby boomers, those of you who were born or alive in the 1950s, and this comes from a Dr. Michael Castle. Long ago and far away in a land that time forgot, before the days of Dylan or the dawn of Camelot, there lived a race of innocents, and they were you and me. For Ike was in the White House in that land where you were born, where navels were oranges and Peyton Place was porn. We learned to gut a muffler, we washed our hair at dawn, we spread our clothes on dry lawns, and we longed for love and romance and waited for our prince, and Eddie Fisher married Liz, and no one's seen him since. We danced a little darling and sang to Stagger Lee, and cried for Buddy Holly in the land that made me me. Only girls wear earrings, and three was one too many, and only boys wore flat top cuts except for G. McKinney. And only in our wildest dreams did we expect to see a boy named George with lipstick in the land that made me me. We fell for Frankie Avalon, and that was very nice. And when they made a movie, they never made it twice. We didn't have a Star Trek V or a Psycho 2, 3, or a Rambo 20 in the land that made me me. Miss Kitty had a heart of gold and Chester had a limp, and Reagan was a Democrat whose co-star was a chimp. We had Mr. Wizard, but not Mr. T, and Oprah couldn't talk yet in the land that made me me. We had our share of heroes. We never thought they'd go, at least not Bobby Darin or Marilyn Monroe. For youth still was eternal and life was yet to be, and Elvis was forever in the land that made me me. We'd never seen the rock band that was grateful to be dead, and airplanes weren't named Jefferson, and Zeppelins were not led. And Beatles lived in gardens then, and monkeys lived in trees. Madonna was Mary in the land that made me me. We'd never heard of microwaves or telephones in cars, and babies might be bottle-fed, but they were not grown up in jars. And pumping iron got wrinkles out, and dorms were never co-ed in the land of me and me. We hadn't seen enough of jets to talk about the lag, and microchips were what was left at the bottom of a bag. And hardware's a box of nails, and bites came from a flea, and rocket ships were fiction in the land that made me me. Buicks came with portholes, and sideshows came with freaks, and bathing suits came big enough to cover both your cheeks. And Coke came just in bottles and skirts below the knees, and Castor came to power in the land that made me me. We had no Crest with fluoride, and we had no Hill Street Blues. We had no pattern pantyhose or Lipton herbal tea, or primetime ads for those dysfunctions in the land that made me me. There was no Golden Arches, no Perrier's to chill, and fish were not called Wanda, and cats were not called Bill. And middle age was 35, and old was 43, and ancients were our parents in the land that made me me. But all things have a season, and so we've heard them say, and now instead of Maybelline, we swear a Retin A. They send us invitations to join AARP. We've come a long way, baby, from the land that made me me. So now we face a brave new world in slightly larger jeans and wonder why they're using smaller print in magazines And we tell our children's children of the way it used to be long ago and far away in the land that made me, me. And if you didn't grow up in the 50s, you missed the greatest time in history. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride, and the program director is Carol Lee.